You're listening to Midori House first broadcast on the 12th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
I think the one I will remember the most is the one that says, Je suis Charlie, je suis flic, I'm a police officer, and Je suis juif, I'm a Jew.
As more than 1.5 million people march in Paris, why is the rise of Je suis Charlie now causing controversy and debate? Plus...
Right now, the Al-Qaeda message, wherever it's coming from, Syria or Yemen, is gaining traction.
Will events in Paris support the rise of the right and pressure to end EU immigration? Brett Mason, European correspondent for SBS World News Australia, and James Boyes, author of the book Clinton's Grand Strategy, US Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World, are in the studio to give us their take. And later in the programme...
It's all about texture, it's all about interesting fabrication and new modern clean shapes.
With the Men's London Collections event coming to a close, we catch up with the designer, Oliver Spencer. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, lots coming up here on the next hour on Midori House. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
France will deploy 10,000 soldiers on home soil by Tuesday and post almost 5,000 extra police officers to protect Jewish sites after the killing of 17 people by Islamist militants in Paris last week. Earlier, Monocle's correspondent in Paris, Tom Burgess-Watson, was asked if he felt that the French public was being reassured by this show of strength.
Well, for quite some time now, certainly since Wednesday, there's been a much more visible security presence on the streets of Paris. Across the country, in fact, in places deemed to be sensitive, namely places that are possible targets that would make favorable targets for extremists. And that's meant at tourist attractions, at synagogues, at schools, and so on. So this is not going to feel markedly different from how it's felt from the past few days.
Meanwhile, the Vatican has denied press reports on Monday that it had received specific warnings from Israeli and US intelligence services that it was a probable next target of an Islamist attack. US officials say Cuba has completed the release of 53 political prisoners agreed as part of last month's historic deal between the two countries, saying it was a very positive development. However, the US said the release did not resolve the larger human rights problems on the island. Indonesian Navy divers say the black box flight data recorder from the wreck of the crashed Air Asia passenger jet is in good condition. They have retrieved it from the Java Sea in a major step towards investigators discovering the cause of the crash that killed all 162 people on board. It's thought bad weather played a part in the crash. Authorities have played down claims earlier today that the plane suffered an explosion just before the crash due to a loss of air pressure. Tantong Kurniadi is head of the National Transportation Safety Committee there. He hopes the data recorders will provide key information.
These flight data recorders seems good, but it depends to the memory inside the rocket chip. But I'm sure that according to our experience, that these flight data recorders can be opened and they can be read in a good condition.
New York City will pay $17 million to settle wrongful conviction claims brought on behalf of three brothers who spent decades in prison before being exonerated of murder in cases linked to a police detective whose actions are under official review. The settlement stems from the convictions of half-brothers Robert Hill, Alvina Jeanette and Daryl Austin in separate fatal shootings in the 1980s. Austin died in prison in 2000. The men spent a cumulative 60 years in prison before their convictions were quashed last year. And finally, some sports news now, and the world number two Roger Federer and Australian great tennis player Leighton Hewitt launched a new format of tennis called Fast Four in Sydney today. First, the two were driven at speed to Sydney Opera House in speedboats, hitting tennis balls back and forth as they travelled. On arrival at the Opera House, they took up their places on court and played a very light-hearted game before a real exhibition game at a city arena, which Federer won. That match was played under the Fast Four format, in which each set is played up to four games with no lets, 1-point deuces. Tie breaks up to 5 points if the set is tied at 5-all. The format comes from Tennis Australia and is designed to speed up and simplify matches for busy people. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
So, thank you, Jonathan, for the news. Lots coming up here on the next hour, Midori House. But first of all, a short break.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06, and it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are European correspondent for SBS World News in Australia, Brett Mason, and author of Clinton's Grand Strategy, US Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World, James Boyce. So sorry, we have to give you your full book title there, James. And
you did, and it's okay. I just picked up my copy of it today.
So. Oh, good. It's quite a long title. Anyway, welcome both to the programme. Brett, before we jump in, I understand you have some breaking news about ISIS that you have picked up on the way in.
Yeah, we're just looking on Twitter. The US Central Command's official Twitter account seems to have been compromised, as well as its YouTube channel, and people reporting to be ISIS operatives are threatening the families of US soldiers. They're in fact publishing the private details, email addresses, phone numbers of US generals who are currently serving in the fight against ISIS. And there is a lot of activity on Twitter talking about this. And at the moment, of course, US President Barack Obama is giving a speech about cybersecurity. So a very interesting timing. Of course, we don't know who is responsible and whether these details are legitimate, but a lot of chat about this online in the last few moments.
Well, we'll return to that later on in the program when we have a bit more of a chance to verify what's going on. We'll come back to you about that in the next few minutes. Now, more than 1.5 million people marched through the streets of Paris yesterday in a mass show of unity after the events of last week. Some of the world leaders who joined the French president included the British Prime Minister David Cameron, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and the EU President Donald Tusk. One slightly contentious guest, however, was Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu, who apparently, after being asked not to attend for fears the Israeli-Palestinian conflict might overshadow the somber mood, decided to turn up nevertheless. While full of political identities and characters, ideally this was meant to be seen as a show of unity above politics. Did he make the right call in attending? James, a tricky one, because you know he is the leader of Israel, and there was obviously a very strong anti-Semitic Jewish angle to this story. It may have been strange if he didn't attend, and I understand that obviously many of his political rivals from Israel were attending as well. Do you think he made the right call?
I do. I think it was strange that if he wasn't asked to attend to a speech about freedom of speech, what does that say about the values that are being defended, quite frankly? There's no doubt that where Bibi Netanyahu goes, controversy follows. But when you look at what it was that was being celebrated, what it was that was being advocated, I think the idea that you would have the leader of the Jewish state not be invited, not attend, would have been problematic in itself, quite frankly. So I think the fact that he was there, demonstrating his solidarity with regard to this movement, was a good thing. And I think the bigger question is, why would he have been asked not to go, quite frankly?
Well, Brett, I think that some of the suggestions were, one, that there was a security issue, and two, as we said, that the debate would focus on Middle Eastern politics. And I understand that Abbas was quickly invited to make sure that there was a kind of a nice lineup. Haaretz, the liberal newspaper, who is, we have to say, very critical of Netanyahu, has run a piece today saying that he apparently pushed his way to the front of the line, was anxious to be first on the bus, and they're criticising him for being a little bit gauche and waving to the crowds and not quite getting the mood of the room. Do you think that's fair?
Well, look, I was there, and I think that the fact that there were so many world leaders, including the Israeli leader was symbolic, and I think that him being there brought great comfort and also reminded the French people that that the world leaders were not afraid to be there and that this was something bigger than politics. And, you know, I didn't sense that watching the march. I didn't sense, I thought all of the world leaders got the rude mood right. And I also think that there was a lot of really unusual showing of emotion from world leaders embracing each other and the symbolic linking of arms. Of course, this was a photo opportunity. That's what this was meant to be. It was meant to be a deliberate photo opportunity to show the world and to show Parisians that the streets are safe and that everyone in the world, or largely everyone in the world, is condemning what took place here. And I think given the attack on the Jewish community in particular, if he wasn't there, I think that it would be a much bigger story. The fact that he was there really in Paris isn't really a big story. Most people are talking about the remarkable lineup. There isn't, on the streets, people aren't saying how inappropriate it was that he was invited to attend.
Although, James, he did use the opportunity to say that he suggested, you know, that there would be a welcome mat in Israel for French Jews who wanted to leave France, which, you know, is probably not the day to kind of air that view. And also the other thing is, you know, that, you know, surely he should be doing whatever he can to kind of support, you know, Jewish communities within Europe. You know, for the, all of our, you know, diversity and our strength, we need these communities to stay invested in our countries. We need to do what we can to help all sorts of communities. Do you think it was, you know, again, the right moment to say, actually, perhaps it's time for you to leave?
You know, I to be fair, I'm going to defer to Britt on this. Britt was there on the ground, took the temperature of the room, and he's probably as well placed as anybody to comment upon this. But I think, to be honest, you know, to come back to my earlier answer, if he hadn't gone, it would have been bad. And once he was in France with the huge French Jewish community, who I understand are the largest Jewish community who moved to Israel out of Europe, it would have been odd that he wasn't saying, look, you know, we are you know, a safe haven for you in times of crisis, in times of good times, in bad. We exist, you know, as a harbor for the Jewish community. You know, if he hadn't said that, that would have been strange. And don't forget, also, let's be honest about it, Bibi Netanyahu is up for re-election. There's a general election coming on in Israel in the coming months. Any politician is going to make sure that he is putting himself forward or herself forward in as favourable a light as possible, both for the international and the all-important domestic community that he needs to appeal to.
And we haven't heard the thing. Not everything he said has been reported either. I mean, I'm not here to defend the man at all. But, you know, there was a lot of hypocrisy in the leaders that were there, supposedly in the name of free speech, with journalists being beaten and locked up in their countries. Mm. And the crowd was very much aware of that. But the overwhelming emotion from everyone that I spoke to, hundreds of them, was that this was something bigger than these politics. No one on the street was talking about these political issues. They were aware of what it was, but they knew that this was a very important moment for this country to grieve and get on with it. And I really don't think that, you know, him going to the synagogue and talking to the community, that's what those people wanted. Like the Australians in Paris were pleased to see the Australian delegation there. It was a big world affair, and he was playing to his audience. And as you say, of course there's politics involved. They're all politicians, 46 of them, I think, gathered together. Not everyone's going to be pleased. And wherever you know, Benjamin Netanyahu goes, there's going to be controversy. People are going to be outraged with something that he does say or something that he doesn't have to say.
Now, Brett, what did you were there. What did you make of the, you know, everyone's gathering behind this hashtag, you know, Je suis Charlie? And that line, you know, that lineup of people standing behind these few words, It's going to be hard to hold, isn't it? Because at the moment we have united behind that simple phrase, people from the right and people from the left, people from every community. And this week we're going to see the publication of the latest issue of Charlie Hebdo, and they've already said that they intend to reprint the Mohammed cartoons. Now, it's going to be a bit more difficult for some on the left and some who were not invested in what that magazine was doing, who've, you know, of course, kind of come out in support of all the people who were killed. But do you think it's going to be difficult? And actually, some people are going to be a bit more cautious about saying, you know, Je suis Charlie after that magazine comes out and as we see events unpack a little bit this week.
Well, I think one of the politicians there summed it up very well yesterday when they said that today is about the people tomorrow is about the politics, and I think that's a fair call. I think you're right. There is, let's not beat about the bush here, there are very conflicted opinions in Paris and France more widely at the moment. I think that there will be people who will exploit this, all of these events, both the atrocities that led to the march and the march itself. And you're right, the publishing of that magazine will in many ways enrage some people, and it will be very difficult for others who perhaps marched or have used the hashtag to continue that. But, you know, I think that most people there that I spoke to in Paris, again, there was more an anger that the right to a sense of humor, that the right to satire was questioned. I think that there was a belief that almost every institution, every religion, everyone really in that crowd had a right to be offended at some point in the publication's history, and probably was. And it's unfortunate that some people respond more differently to others. And I've been to a lot of marches, demonstrations, protests. I've been to lots of outpouring of emotions after tragedies, and this was the most diverse crowd I have ever seen at any of these events. There were families, there were Muslims, there were Christians, there were atheists, there were a huge array of people that were there for many different reasons. And I think ultimately that Wednesday's publication will be a big success, and there'll be people that are critical, but I think it's symbolic that they do go ahead and print those cartoons. I think that if they didn't, it sort of loses its impact in a way.
James, the merit and the durability of Je Suis Charlie, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's fascinating how few people will have ever read this magazine who are now jumping all over it. You know, I'm reminded of two things. I'm reminded of the Frankie Says Relax t-shirts and the Bring Back Our Girls hashtag thing that Michelle Obama was sitting there moping about in that photograph. You know, it's a very easy, trendy thing to get behind. One of the things I loathe on Twitter is these commentators who have a speciality and they focus on such and such, and then they become generalists and now they're wanting to freedom of speech and everything along those lines. I've very deliberately stayed away from that. This idea that it's an easy, trendy thing to get behind for 5 minutes, people who have never read the magazine will feel I should be doing this. But of course, do they understand the implications, the politics, for example, of this publication, which I think most people certainly don't, certainly far further to the left, as I understand it, than most publications in this country. People have likened it to Private Eye. I think they'd be quite surprised, from what I understand, if they saw the true content of it. However, you know, as people working within the public eye, within media, it's important to stand up and defend these interests for everybody's sake. And one hopes that once the media focus upon this and the sort of 15 minutes worth of fame that it attracts passes, that there are still people who are prepared to stand up and defend freedom of speech, because we all depend upon it.
Right. It's easy to tweet it, and that yeah. was, if I'm frank, I share your dislike of these sort of trends and bandwagons that people tend to jump on. But in the immediate aftermath, it's very easy to send that tweet. But honestly, there were a lot of people who were very concerned about that rally taking place, that unity march. There were genuine fears about what might happen next. And it wasn't easy. I mean, for some, it was that there was no way they weren't going to not show up. But to actually that many Parisians to take to the streets and stand there not moving for 5 or 6 hours, that's how slowly this massive procession moved, to actually turn out is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, James. Just let me clarify that. I certainly distinguish between those who come out and stand on the streets and march and stand in solidarity. My point was more about those sort of all too eager people in the Twitter sphere, effectively, who jump on the bandwagon present themselves as sort of somehow being at the vanguard of a movement, and 5 minutes later on, it's the next thing.
That's right.
Well, it's the same old problem of, you know, trying to sum up all your opinions in a badge. You know, yeah. And that's all that Twitter is. It's, you know, for people who used to wear a badge. Well, and we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Brett Mason, and James Boyes. When we return, we'll look at how US foreign policy has impacted on terrorist training grounds in Yemen.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships.
And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And still with me are Brett Mason and James Boyce. Now, at the top of the show, we had some breaking news. And just to turn our attention back to that, it does seem that US Central Command's Twitter account has indeed been hacked, or it has been hacked as an organization. But whoever has hacked this account is trying to make it look like ISIS, apparently, although the authenticity is, of course, yet to be determined. However, the account has published what appear to be the private details of US military personnel. A YouTube page purporting to belong to US Central Command also appears to have been hacked. But we'll continue with our program now and bring you more on that story as it develops over the next half hour. Now, it was only in October that the US was calling Yemen an example of successful counter-terrorism strategies. But on the same day of the Charlie Hebdo attack, a car bomb was detonated in Sana'a, the capital, amongst a crowd of people who were lining up to enroll in the city's police force. With the global dialogue always focused these days on Iraq, Syria and Afghanistan, have we perhaps forgotten what's happening in Yemen? James, this is a situation you know about. Yemen is a difficult place because, you know, it's not on the reporters kind of, you know, we go there for emergencies. We don't cover it in a great way, all news organisations. What do you make of what's been happening in Yemen?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I think what you've got is a White House which has agendas, focuses, and a grand strategy at which, you know, Yemen is not at the vanguard, quite frankly. And I'm sure that doesn't surprise anybody. You've got an administration also which is preparing to leave office in under 2 years now. So people are looking ahead. Yemen is not the forefront of anybody's mind, quite frankly, in Washington, D.C. There are greater priorities, both domestically and internationally. And so as a result of that, you know, the operation in Yemen is going to slip as a result of that. There is no great domestic pressure. Nobody talks about the Yemen lobby, for crying out loud, on Capitol Hill, or even really any lobby from that region of the world. So there is no domestic pressure to increase the operational presence in that part of the world, or really to do an awful lot about what's happening. And as a result of that, Yemenis are going to suffer.
What's interesting is, you know, the Kouachi brothers at the weekend are Algerians, you know, from a country which has got, you know, had its own Islamist uprising, crushed it brutally, and is now run in a semi-secret police kind of way. There's, you know, it doesn't have the situation of a Syria or of an Iraq, but yet people from the country are still being radicalized, and as we've seen the actions at the weekend. Do you think it makes it quite difficult for all of this policy in the region? It doesn't seem to be, you know, you can't tell that it's a country that's on the edge of falling apart or a country that seems to be ticking along in a kind of more regulated way. It could be anyone from any of these countries that is potentially going to be radicalized and become, you know, a terrorist.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the problems we have is that we sit here quite comfortably in the West, and we talk about exporting democracy and bringing freedom to peoples, and how terrible it is when good folks are ruled by dictators. But as someone who works with international students, I can assure you that a number of those students from these parts of the world, where we've attempted to export democracy or impose Western certain values look at me and say, what the hell's going on? You know, these are not our values. You're exporting them to us and we're not used to it. And this occurs in all the countries where the so-called Arab Spring occurred and where, you know, we are now continuing to meddle effectively. And it's very difficult because we want, I think, to bring, you know, peace and security to these parts of the world on the basis that it'll increase our security. And that's certainly the American position. But all too often, we've seen that backlash against Western states, and this idea of blowback, for example, which has emerged in the last several decades, is a real tangible threat that we're all facing as a result of these policies, I think.
Brett, I want to bring you on a slightly different topic, which is, you know, also at the weekend, Viktor Orban, who's the Hungarian PM, he said that looking at the events that had happened in France, it was clear that EU immigration had to be stopped. And he was talking about economic migration, even when you needed people who, for your indices, he was saying only ever caused troubles. You know, maybe in a few examples, political asylum should go ahead, but all migration should be stopped. You know, this debate following, again, the events in Paris, do you feel it is going to be, in the end, more supportive of the right, even though we've seen a successful time for Hollande? Is going to be more the right-wing parties that gain from this, or try to gain from it?
They'll certainly try to gain, but it's very difficult to sort of determine. Of course, there will be the people that always held those opinions, and now they have the forum, the opportunity, the context to express those opinions and those views and test them on the wider population. But I think the randomness, I mean, obviously there are massive intelligence questions hanging over Paris and not only or France more generally, but also the US, that seems that everyone had sort of pulled down the mission accomplished banner with Yemen and forgot to keep an eye on what was happening there, despite red flag after red flag after red flag over a number of years with the people involved in these attacks. But I think the randomness of the attack has shown a lot of people that you can't possibly police in terms of immigration. You can't determine who may or may not be responsible for these attacks. I mean, this is a classic example where even when you have those flags that should be ringing warning bells, they don't. And I think that a lot of Parisians, again, it's a cross-section that I spoke to on the streets, a sort of litmus test. I think most people are very proud of the fact that Paris, Europe, people move around. There are lots of cultures. There are Australians. There are people from all over the world living there. And I think that's what makes it a great modern city. And I think that people are very passionate about maintaining that. But in the political context, I'm not so sure. I think there will be sections of the community, particularly in the far right, who will gain some support. But I don't know. I really sensed a general voter mood of unity. I didn't sense that sort of political anger. I felt more of a personal pain than any sort of outrage or call to sort of shut the borders and pull down the shutters and sort of put a ring fence around the nation. And I don't sort of sense that in the wider continent, except in those countries or those regimes that have been sort of championing that cause before this attack.
James, do you feel this is, you know, going to be a rallying call for the right?
Well, it's interesting. You know, coming back to some of your earlier questions with regards to people jumping on the bandwagon about the Je suis Charlie hashtag, I think it will be seen as political opportunism of the worst possible kind if parties of the right try to, you know, jump on the bandwagon, which is advocating a magazine of the far left, quite frankly. And I think, you know, that really comes back to some of your initial points and where that would be hypocrisy of the worst form, quite frankly. Will parties of the right attempt to do so? I say they will. The extent to which they're successful, I think, will be dependent very much upon the specific countries that they're working in. And in trying to talk quite broadly, I think we miss the idea that obviously within certain countries, the right have a far stronger hold. I know a lot of people in this country are concerned about the rise of UKIP, for example. But I think that when it comes to voting, for example, I think that Nigel Farage will have a hard time trying to really make an awful lot of leeway with regard to this. And perhaps it's an opportunity for David Cameron to try and position himself very much as a voice of moderation on the centre-right, but, you know, very much talking about freedom, but within freedom within a context.
But the right doesn't have to say much. It just has to plant the seed and let people sort of make those decisions in their communities. And that's what will be interesting. It will be what the people on the street think and whether that gains momentum, as opposed to, I think, given the scale scale of what's happened, it's a political opportunity, but it's a hard one for them, as you say, mm-hmm. to seize. And it's what will determine it ultimately is how the people will have reacted, and most of them, as we've seen, are very optimistic about what's happened.
Brett, we're almost at the time for the news, but just in a few seconds, you know, you seem, as you say, you're a hardened newsman. You went to this event. It strikes me that you were greatly moved by what you saw happen there. Just for our listeners, what was it that really moved you? Is it sheer numbers, that, you know, that idea that, you know, two people causes this trouble, but all these millions of people came onto the street?
Well, I spoke to one Frenchman and he said these attacks were designed to bring France to its knees. Instead, they brought the world to its feet. And it's very, I mean, and it sounds, it's a cliche, but it was so stark when you were there. And the thing that really struck me was the diversity of the crowd that were there, and the determination, and also the passion to defend a free press, seeing, and particularly it's our profession. So seeing those pens and pencils being held high up in the air was really moving. They had a sort of shrine of pens and pencils. People would stop and businessmen would take pens out of their suit pocket and toss it down. School girls and boys would put their pens and pencils down. And sure, symbolism, but really quite powerful. And while, yes, it centres on Charlie Hebdo, a particular magazine, I think that this was about something bigger than that. And, you know, and I think it's an example. In our country, we recently had an attack, and we went through a similar grieving process. And I think that the way in which the continent, in particular Europe, despite its political differences at the moment, came together, it was quite amazing to see.
Well, Brett, thank you very much indeed. That was Brett Mason and James Boyes. And thank you very much, both of you, for joining us here on Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Well, we've got lots still to come in the second half of Midori House, including...
Very simply put, we are going for a cleaner look, so that will lend to a more futuristic sort of Eiffel, if you like. We are definitely using fabrications that are more progressive.
We'll hear from Oliver Spencer at this year's London Collections menswear event. But before that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. France will deploy 10,000 soldiers on home soil by Tuesday and post almost 5,000 extra police officers to protect Jewish sites after the killing of 17 people by Islamist militants in Paris last week. Meanwhile, the Vatican has denied press reports today that it had received specific warnings from Israeli and US intelligence services that it was probably the next target of an Islamist attack. Indonesian Navy divers say the black box flight data recorder from the wreck of the crashed Air Asia passenger jet is in good condition. They've retrieved it from the Java Sea. And New York City will pay $17 million to settle wrongful conviction claims brought on behalf of three brothers who spent decades in prison before being exonerated of murder in cases linked to a police detective whose actions are under official review. And that's the latest news for the moment on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. And the time here in London is 18:32, meaning it's 21:32 in Moscow. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Budapest to talk to our correspondent there, Adam Labor. Adam, thank you very much for coming on the show. Maybe we could just pick up with you quickly on this topic we were discussing about the suggestion by Viktor Orban that migration should be stopped in Europe. How's that been reported in Hungary?
Well, it's had a fair bit of play here, obviously, because it's very topical at the moment. And also, you know, whatever the Prime Minister says is generally news. But, I mean, it's a strange thing in a way to be saying, because there's very little migration in immigration in Hungary. I mean, Hungary is a transit country. People pass through. Quite a lot of asylum seekers and refugees do pass through, and the UN has a big refugee operation here. But very few people want to come and settle in Hungary. No, if you can get into the EU, people tend to go to Austria or Germany. So it's slightly seen as being a bit odd that he's saying this. And I think it's also being seen as a bit of a playing to the gallery on the right, because this is, of course, the kind of thing that the far right Jobbik party has been saying, and they're quite joyful saying, oh, look, now the Prime Minister agrees with us. But in terms of Hungary itself, it's not an issue.
Well, you should focus on what's happening in Europe, because there's a few kind of high-profile visitors heading to see Mr. Orbán, including Merkel and Putin. Is this coincidence that both are pitching up at the same time? And you know, we know that Mr. Orbán is a mercurial character, but who will he favour, do you feel?
Well, I think he's trying to do a balancing act here. He's had an opening to Russia, which has unsettled a lot of people. It certainly unsettled the Americans. Hungary did a deal with the Russians that the Russians will lend Hungary 10 billion euros or so to revitalize, to revamp the Paks nuclear power station. There was no tender, no public discussion of it. It was just presented as a fait accompli. And that set alarm bells ringing. Plus, Hungary for a while was rather equivocal on the whole question of sanctions on Ukraine. Although it does go along with the EU line as an EU member, it's hardly been one of the most enthusiastic. And in fact, it's been probably one of the least enthusiastic. So there's that opening to Russia, but at the same time, economic reality is that Hungary is a member of the European Union, and its economy is firmly linked to the German economy. A large part of the economy is based on exports, and the German car manufacturers who have factories here, I mean, for example, when they stopped work in summer over the summer break, you know, you could see the figures changing just because of that small sector is very influential. So he has to do the traditional Hungarian balancing act between East and West, but he certainly turned a bit too far east for many people to be comfortable with.
Adam, just explain to me what the politics of this are. I know that he doesn't like the fact that, you know, Germany and much of the EU is critical of what they see as his attempts to roll back on the progress of democracy and his willingness to curtail press freedom. But Russia seems like an unlikely bedfellow in many senses. You know, Orbán, we think of him sitting on the right, and obviously Mr. Putin is not sitting in exactly the same kind of position. What is it that unites these two men?
Well, it's a very strange thing. A lot of people here are still puzzling over this. I mean, Viktor Orbán shot to fame in 1989 at one of the first, one of the last rallies under communism, telling a quarter of a million people that it was time for the Russians to go home. And the Fidesz party has always been very much, until recently, predicated on a move, you know, against Russia, we're for the West. You know, Russia occupied Hungary for something like 45 years, and everyone, not everyone, but it was probably like 95% of people were pretty glad when the Russians went home. So this turn to Russia, I think, is partly giving a sort of two fingers to the EU, saying, look, you know, you can attack us and criticize us all you want, but, you know, we know you're never going to throw us out, because that's far too complicated and too much work. And so we're going to cozy up to Russia a bit. You know, we have Russia as well. Now, you know, Mr. Orbán's defenders say, just take a look at the map. I mean, Hungary is on the eastern fringe of Europe. It borders Ukraine, which used to be the former Soviet Union. It has to have a working relationship with Russia as well. It always, you know, it has done through the centuries, and it has to continue doing that now.
Now, another story which is connected to the, you know, events of the weekend is that it turns out that back in December, the Hungarians stopped two French men who were attempting to cross the country to join ISIS. How has this story just come to the head now then?
There was an interview with a Hungarian policeman who's running part of the anti-terrorist branch of the Hungarian police, and he just said this, and it's very interesting, because it shows really that you know, the Schengen zone ends on the Hungarian border, or much of the Hungarian border. Hungary borders with Serbia and Romania and Ukraine and Croatia, none of which are in the Schengen zone. So the great operation for people smugglers is to get people across the Hungarian border, because once you're inside Hungary, there's no more border checks until the Atlantic coast of Portugal. So this is really the last place where there's proper checks and controls. So it's no coincidence that they got caught there.
But is there a suggestion that this is commonplace, or that, you know, that Hungary is a kind of a route for people heading eastwards and trying to head down to Syria?
It doesn't seem to be a suggestion that it's common. I mean, it's interesting that he, you know, that he said this, because normally, you know, I think these kind of things that people don't really, you know, public officials don't really give information out about them. So I don't think it's that common, or we'd be hearing about it much more. I mean, what certainly is common is traffic coming the other way, is that asylum seekers and refugees and economic migrants pouring through the Balkans and up into Hungary, partly because there's been so many horror stories about the boats in the Mediterranean overturning and people drowning, and the EU announcing that they're not going to do any more rescue operations. So the land route has become much more popular. And so Hungary's eastern frontier, along with also with Poland and Slovakia, which are in the Schengen zone, is very much the, you know, the frontier of Europe now.
Now, the last time I came to visit you in Budapest, I think you recommended going to one of the famous outdoor swimming pools. But it seems there's another tourist attraction you might be directing me to next time.
Yes, there's this strange kind of trap games, or escape games, they call them, where people pay a certain amount of money and you're kind of dropped into a real-life 3D Dungeons and Dragons, if anyone remembers that from a few years ago, where you're locked in and you're given these various clues, which might be a doll or some hieroglyphs on the wall or a fraction of a map or something, and you have to use those to get out within a certain time. And it's proving very popular. And, you know, Hungarians have always been very ingenious people. And this seems to be their latest invention that's proving very popular. I think it's also because there's so many computer games now that people really like the idea of, you know, trying to live the actual 3D experience in real life of getting out of somewhere, using their brain and using their intuition.
Well, perhaps they're inspired by Mr. Orban, who seems to be able to wriggle out of his issues between Mr. Putin and Ms. Merkel. So congratulations to Hungary anyway. Adam, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we're going to check in with the menswear designer, Oliver Spencer.
Spirit, love, energy and culture. To be quickly accessible, unreroute the river, let the damned water be this, and people down the way this thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. One of London's more exciting fashion events is coming to a close. London Collections Men promises all the suave sophistication that people expect from this great city. Well, Monocle's David Pleasant caught up with one of the men behind one of the most successful brands here, and one of the youngest too, Oliver Spencer.
Oliver, I've just pulled you aside. We're just about to start the actual show. Congratulations on a wonderful collection. I've just had a sneaky peek. Can you tell us what the inspirations are this year, what you've gone through, what your process has been up till now, and what's resulted? What have you got in front of us for today?
David Nash, the sculptor, painter, and his basic use of colour, tones. It's all about texture. It's all about interesting fabrication and new modern clean shapes. I'm trying to be quite brave with what I'm doing, but also quite serious at the same time.
So, I mean, the shapes and sort of forms, there's a sort of futuristic element to it. It's not that kind of vintage style that perhaps we've become used to. Maybe explain that. Obviously, this is a radio program. What kinds of materials, what sort of colours and shapes are you going for?
Very simply put, we are going for a cleaner look, so that will lend to a more futuristic sort of eyeful, if you like. And we are definitely using fabrications that are more progressive.
Nice trousers that we saw, kind of like quilted trousers.
Quilted trousers are fun. Yeah, there's a lot going on and layering. But yes, I really had a really precise look in mind, and I think it's coming across.
If we look more broadly at the London collections and what that means for your brand and your company, I mean, how have you seen that progress? How does it stand in your calendar, in your kind of schedule nowadays?
Oh, it's been amazing. It's just absolutely bumped me up and bumped me up. And I don't know where I'd be without it, because I wouldn't be over in France showing. I think it's amazing. And we started showing before they started doing the thing properly, and then they did the thing properly, and my God, it was amazing. Thanks to Dylan and all the team at the BFC, so it's fantastic.
And one last question. I mean, in terms of your design process...
I think they're all out smoking.
Really? go right through that entrance there.
There's a lot going on, frenetic activity here backstage. In terms of your design process, if you can kind of sum it up, I mean, it seems like you keep quite a tight grip on things. You're very much at the helm. How does it work in terms of delegating, in terms of kind of sharing that sort of design workload? Explain maybe to the listeners what Oliver Spencer's about in terms of the design process.
Yeah, at the helm, I am at the helm, but I have an amazing ship with a hell of a good crew, and it's completely about collaboration and pooling resources and everybody working together. We all sit down and decide where we think we need to be going. I never like to refer to people as being my team, which people like to refer to. We all work together. We're all in it together. She sails or she sinks.
Well, that was David Pleasant speaking to the menswear designer Oliver Spencer. And we're going to stay on the topic of fashion now, because I'm joined in the studio by men's fashion critic for the Financial Times, Charlie Porter. Charlie, we were just talking before while that piece was playing out. London suddenly has got to a bit of a critical mass on this. You know, it started off as a small affair, but it was a big weekend.
It is, and the thing with it is that 3 years ago we didn't have any schedule at all. There was like one day at the end of the women's wear, and it's so strange. It's such a crazy thing that like within 3 years suddenly there's this week where Tom Ford shows here and Burberry shows here, and these brands that wouldn't show in a city if it didn't make financial sense. They're all here and they're all kind of proud about it.
And how many brands then were showing here who are not really based here? So, you know, is Tom Ford...
Tom is actually based here. Like, Tom is based here. I mean, actually, Moschino have come over here, and it makes perfect sense for Moschino, because, like, if they just showed in the hometown of Milan, then it would be really weird, because, like, Jeremy Scott's stuff is really poppy and it really fits with what happens in London. Whereas Milan's really dry, so it makes sense for people like them to come here. Actually, also Coach was a new one this year as well, which is Stuart Vevers, and that was very interesting because so basically New York, this might get a bit technical, but New York doesn't have a men's schedule at the moment. They do menswear shows at the same time as women's wear, which is kind of pointless because the buying's already done. So for Coach to come here shows that London is more important in menswear than New York, but New York are really jealous of London. They're trying to work out how they can copy what we're doing.
And Charlie, of the things you saw, what were the standouts, do you think?
So this morning was a show by Craig Green, who is the most extraordinary designer, and he was Louise Wilson, the professor from St Martin's, who died last year, who's nurtured so many of them. He's like her last great success, and his show was extraordinary this morning, and stores fight over him, and his stuff sells. It's a real sign that young designers can sell stuff. It's not just for show.
I struggled a bit over the weekend. It's always difficult when you see the reporting of these events. You know, there's always the showstoppers, all the coverage, and you kind of lose track that there is some business going on here as well. So did Maharishi kind of like give a nod to ISIS? And oh God, please, did you feel that there was there's some real kind of serious good design that's commercial?
Yeah, totally. But the thing also is that it's often in stuff that you would never see as business. Like I've just seen the show by Nazir Mazar, which is to a any eye would call streetwear, but Selfridges can't get enough of the stuff, and they do really big business with it. And then people like Dunhill, which is more traditional, it gives itself a new identity, which it's kind of struggled to gain in the past. It you can see business happening. But also the week wouldn't be here if business wasn't being done. It wouldn't exist if it didn't make commercial sense.
So Dunhill, you know, what did you make of their show? Interesting time for them, as you say. There is, you know, another period of change, and
it was great. Like, basically, John Ray is their newish designer. He was one of the ones that took over from Tom Ford at Gucci when Tom first left, and John's been away for a long while, and he's really made Dunhill have like a real sense of confidence, and it feels assured. Whereas I think before, it's not really known quite what it was. And also the great thing was that he worked with Katie Grand, who's a really playful stylist. So it meant also that these traditional clothes didn't look kind of boring. They had a bit of a twist to them.
Well, Charlie, I'm afraid we haven't given you a huge amount of time, but thank you so much for taking some time to come in and see us. That's Charlie Porter from the Financial Times. It's time for a little bit of music now. Here's the American singer-songwriter SZA with a track from her album titled Zed, and this is Green Mile. Well, that was SZA with Green Mile. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and the time here in London now is 18:52. And it's time for our daily arts review. And today we're going to talk art with visual arts editor of the artsdesk.com, Fison Guna. Fison, welcome to the show. Now, we're going to start with something that's happening here at Somerset House in London. This is this wonderful old building that was a palace, and it was turned into a home for the Inland Revenue, and now it's home to everything from the Courtauld Institute to other art galleries. But it's holding a kind of art meets the pop world exhibition, which is getting a bit of a buzz. It's PJ Harvey.
Yeah, I mean, PJ Harvey fans are really in for a treat. She's in collaboration with Art Angel, who commission really exciting artworks from an assortment of artists. They've done sound works before Art Angel with contemporary artists, but nothing like this. From a musician.
What's actually happening in this? Have you seen it? Heard anything?
Haven't yet, because it opens on Friday. Okay. The press are going to go in at some time midweek. It's very much anticipated. It's quite an unusual thing for Art Angel to commission. It's basically, we're going to watch PJ Harvey record her 9th album. Basically, there'll be a one-way mirror installed in a room in Somerset House. It's actually a former gymnasium at Somerset House, which you said, you know, was the former Inland Revenue. And it's basically going to be a recording studio, as a normal recording studio, where she'll literally be recording with her band her 9th album. And visitors in 45-minute time slots can, in small groups, basically watch through it's a one-way mirror, actually. She said they can't see us, she can't see us, but we'll be able to look on at what's going on in the recording studio. So you know, all sorts of exciting things can be happening. You know, we can probably, you know, it's basically the evolution of her 9th album. So yeah.
We need to get you back in after it's open.
I can't wait.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah. Okay. It's very brave of her. I mean, she's done all sorts of interesting artistic collaborations before in the past and worked with really interesting people. So this isn't that unusual for her, but it's still an intriguing... We'll wait to see if anything interesting happens.
Now, some time ago when you were in here, we were talking about a show that was on Tate, I believe. This was the Malevich show. And we were talking about a black square that he had painted.
Yeah,
and now that black square is back to haunt us again. Is it the Whitechapel? Well, is it the inspiration for a show at the Whitechapel?
It's the inspiration. Last year, those who may remember that Tate had a big show of the Russian modernist artist called Malevich. And in 1915, he painted a black square. It was literally a black square on white, a revolutionary artwork. And it's the anniversary of that artwork. And that's where the title comes from for the Whitechapel's new exhibition, which is Adventures of the Black Square. Abstract Art and Society, 1915 to 2015. So it's looking at abstract art and the development of abstract art over a huge 100-year time span. And it's looking at the way artists have painted abstract art as and the abstract work has been tied to political changes and changes in society. So Malevich's Black Square was very much rooted to sort of what was happening in revolutionary Russia. So it's looking at it from a kind of political angle, you know, the development of abstract art.
Now, the final thing you want to put the spotlight on is the opening of a new gallery dedicated to drawing. Where is this?
Ah, this is at the Courtauld Gallery, the marvellous Courtauld Gallery, which
in
is
in the
also,
same courtyard as
Somerset
House.
Yeah, it's very near Somerset House. So if you want to visit one, they're both, all the exhibitions that I'm mentioning are opening this week. The Courtauld Gallery's new wing, it's a new drawing ring, so it's a new building, is opening this Thursday. And it's called the Gilberton Il Deco Butler Gallery. I think I'm saying it right. And it's basically dedicated to drawing. The Courtauld Gallery has a marvellous collection of impressionist paintings, but it also has this superb collection of about 7,000 drawings from old masters, from the Renaissance to Rembrandt to Rubens to contemporary drawings of, you know, of 20th century and 21st century artists. But it's never had a dedicated gallery to show them in. So this is going to show off some of their collection. And it's kicking off with an exhibition called Unseen. And it's going to show some artists who aren't as well known as some of their superstar artists, but well worth seeing. Because
And across a huge period of time as well, aren't they?
Gosh, yes, yeah. I mean, their collection spans early Renaissance to 20th century, 21st century as well. So there'll be some fascinating works.
And I just went at Christmas to see they've got the drawing exhibition of Sheila on there as well, which is wonderful as well. It's small and perfectly formed. It's quite good.
Yeah. No, the Sheila's definitely worth going to see before it comes down.
Good. Well, thank you very much for Sanguna. She's a visual arts editor of the artsdesk.com and a regular here on Monocle 24. Thank you very much. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Brett Mason and James Boyes. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by David Pleasant, Claire Langister and Henry Reist Sheridan. And our studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the headlines, it's Culture with Mr. Robert Bound. But from me, Andrew Tuck, just time to say goodbye.
Van uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Where are you, London? This is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.